Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore the new paradigm of spirituality, of transformation, of coming into a more conscious awareness of who we are. This week, I have a very interesting guest named Dr. Alan Hunter. He's written the 6 Archetypes of Love. He's a literature professor, and we're going to get into the understanding of archetypes, especially around love for this upcoming Valentine's Day. So, Dr. Alan Hunter, you there?
Yes, I am. Yes, a pleasure to be with you on BBS Radio.
Yes, BBS does what no one else does, so feel free to go in as deep as you want to go into this journey of love, and I've done many programs on sexuality and open relationships. So, in looking at your book, it seems like there's, you know, many ways people have approached love, but do you want to lay out the archetypes as you've gone through them?
Yes, I would be very happy to do that.
Please.
Love is a pretty tricky subject. Most people get it wrong a lot more than they get it right.
Mm.
But if we look at the wisdom of the great literature in the West over 3,500 years, what we'll see is there are 6 archetypes that we're invited to go on, to go through, I should say, on our life journey. Always the same 6, always in the same order.
Mm.
And we've actually forgotten about that paradigm. We've forgotten about that way of looking at reality in the last 200-300 years.
So let me just interrupt for one second. When we're talking about love, we're talking about romantic love, right?
Yes, we are. Definitely.
And you're saying there's 6 stages or levels of development within one relationship, perhaps? This is what you're saying?
There are 6 possible stages. We don't get through all of them because some of us get stuck, which is why I wrote the book, because I saw so many people getting stuck.
Mm, it's true. I don't even get to first base sometimes. But.
Well, I think we can all say that.
No, I want to get through. I want to find out where I'm stuck, and I want to get through that using this model.
Okay. Well, what happens is that if we take as a starting point when we first fall in love, to some extent, whenever we fall in love, we repeat that moment of first love, that sort of, oh my, this is wonderful. It doesn't matter how many times we fall in love.
Well, that's refreshing. Thank you for that, because, you know, after if it's, like, gone flat once or twice, you think, is it ever possible to have that spark? And you're saying it is, so go ahead.
It is. And to take your comment a little further, that spark may be there, but because we're a little bit jaded, we tend to suppress that spark.
Mm.
Well, that initial spark I'm talking about, that's what I call the innocent in love. This is the person who's spontaneous, who loves too much, too readily, is too trusting, perhaps, for his or her own good, and gets hurt because the world is a cruel place.
And people are afraid of it. I mean, I haven't seen too many people totally. If one person's there, the other person says, oh, my God, I'm backing off from this. This is too much.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the innocent is both wonderful and a little scary.
Thanks for telling me now. But
well, I only came to it myself a little while ago.
Okay.
So, but of course, you know, we have to go through life nurturing that idealism about love, because you can't have a decent adult relationship without that trust and love, which is what the innocent has. Now, when we're burned and jaded, we tend to become what I call the orphan, the next stage. And the orphan is the person who looks around and says, you know, I just want someone to glom onto who will do for now.
Right.
Sometimes we do that because we're timid or we've been hurt, and sometimes we get stuck there.
Mm.
And sometimes we reduce our sense of what is possible to what is comfortable or what is convenient.
Mm, I've been stuck there for a couple of years too, yeah.
I think almost everybody has been stuck there for at least once.
Mm-hmm. How do we get out of that stage, yeah? How do we go beyond
Sometimes we're propelled out of it because the next stage is what I call the pilgrim. Mm. And that is what happens when we have a relationship which is sort of okay, but we think, you know, there's got to be more to it.
Mm.
And the pilgrim, like a pilgrim in the bygone eras who would travel in search of truth, says, you know, I deserve something a little better than this, and I'm going to hold out until I get it.
But doesn't that mean letting go of the comfort zone of what you have and the security?
Precisely.
And then most people, actually, I mean not most people, but I know some people that are not brave enough to say, you know, I'm not getting what I want, I'm going to let go. What's a way of convincing them that to take the pilgrim journey?
Well, what I say to my clients in my counseling groups and my students, I say, you know, if you decide you don't want to leave what is comfortable, that's fine as long as it's a conscious decision, as long as you're not saying, oh, I don't know of anything else, so I guess this is it. If you look around and say it's too risky, then that's fine. You know, that's a reasonable reaction to a difficult life circumstance in which there are no guarantees. But most of us, when we've asked that question, when we said, isn't there something more, we're already out of the door, actually.
Right. That's true, but there's always that, people especially who've grown up with a lot of fear and insecurity in their life might tend to hold on to that one longer than they should, but I just want to hear from you saying that the pilgrim's journey is always worth it, would you say?
Well, I think the pilgrim's journey is always worth it. And remember, two people who are gathered together in the relationship where they're both orphans, they both decide that they want to explore what it means together.
Mm-hmm.
And so they both become pilgrims. And then if they ask themselves about their fear and overcome it, then they can make it to the fourth stage, which is where they recommit to each other and themselves as what I call the warrior lover.
But often the person out the door is not going to connect, because usually, in my observation, it's one person that usually kind of expands faster than the other, and the other says, okay, this is complete, and the other person is saying, no, don't go, don't leave. And I think there's usually, it's a separation at that point where they both may become, one may become the orphan, the other becomes the warrior lover, right?
Yeah, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And what I've found often is that when people don't understand that this is just growth and development, they panic, and so the orphan clings to the pilgrim who wants to escape even faster.
Mm-hmm.
If they could see that this is growth and can't really be stopped, then it gives them more options as to how they're going to react to each other.
So this stage, the warrior lover, is really critical. Let's go into this in some depth. Yes.
Well, the warrior lover is it's a contradiction, because war and love are two different things, except that you can't love something unless you're prepared to fight for it, unless you're prepared to stand up for that relationship.
Mm.
You can't really love somebody. And, you know, if it's not worth fighting for, then it's not worth loving.
Hold on one second. So if that person is walking out the door and being the pilgrim, do you actually say, don't go, I'm fighting for this? Would you say that? Or would you say, it's over?
Well, if the person needs to be a pilgrim, probably the best thing you can do is to say, look, you need to be a pilgrim and do the exploring for a while, but I'll still be around. I'll still be here because I see that you're going to make it to Warrior Lover.
Mm-hmm.
That takes patience and it takes dedication. Tough road, but, you know, the payoff is worth it.
So the Warrior Lover, how does one fight for love, in your opinion?
In exactly the way that you've just described, being prepared to dedicate oneself to a relationship no matter what, being prepared to wait whilst the other person goes through uncertainty, or, you know, on a more mundane level, you might say that whenever two people stand up and say, you know, I'm going to be married to you, they're actually putting their life and their money and their future and everything into that relationship. That's a transformation point.
But what if one person's walking out the door because the relationship isn't right and they become the pilgrim, then they're not with a relationship, and then is it back to page one, the innocent again? Or where does the warrior lover pick up after the pilgrim in a kind of fresh environment?
If the warrior lover loses the lover, then that person, in terms of love, you can be a warrior lover in your work, but in terms of love, then that person has to go on another pilgrimage to find another person to whom to devote all this emotional good stuff that he has.
Oh, I see, and then I see. So the warrior lover is standing up for the relationship you already have, no matter what the circumstance, right?
Yes, as long as it's not a relationship that's based on failing to be the full version of yourself. I mean, an orphan will cling to anybody just because he or she is afraid to be alone. That's not the same thing, is it?
Well, no, so the orphan lover would cling, and then that, just to review a little bit, I know you haven't gone too far, but the orphan lover clings, and then the pilgrim emerges and walks away from that clinging. Is that what?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the pilgrim wanders around, finding out who they are and what they want.
Yeah.
And then how does the warrior lover emerge out of the pilgrim?
Well, at a certain point, a pilgrim will find the person and the life that he or she wants and has been waiting for. And it might not be quite what that person had imagined, but I've got enough observation to back this up, that a person will say, you know, this is where I need to put my life energies. And that's the declaration that brings them into warrior, lover, archetype.
So that warrior lover doesn't have the spark of the innocence, does it?
Well, we take everything that we learned at the previous levels with us.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are a warrior lover, you are able to trust and love perhaps a little more wisely. So some of the spontaneity is perhaps muted, but the qualities are still there.
Mm. So in that warrior love relationship, would you say it's a relationship, these things, or it's a one person on both sides have these qualities?
It's a relationship at that point. So one doesn't get warrior lovers too much on their own.
Okay. So in a warrior lover relationship, you talk about in the book, in the bedroom, what does that look like in the bedroom with a warrior lover?
Well, the warrior lover knows that, for instance, promiscuous sex isn't the name of the game, because that person is looking for a real connection to the other person. And that means an emotional connection and a physical connection and a sense of trust as well. And that's a whole different attitude towards sex and sexuality and loving. It's more centered. It's a person saying, this is the person I want to make love with, rather than saying, oh, you know, there's an attractive person, I think I'll try my luck.
So this is this goes to the depth of love. I mean, I think David Data talks about this in some of his books. Have you read the Data books?
I know a little about them, but actually you could say some more. It'd be very great.
No, no, David Data talks about the three stages. There's there's the macho man and the feminine woman, and they've reversed roles where the woman, I mean, it's a different approach to the whole relationship thing. And then the second stage, the woman takes the lead, the man becomes more, a passive. And in the third stage, the roles sort of revert back to their true relationship, where the man can take that woman and ravage the woman, because women, in a way, want to be opened up to God. But it's from a deeper level of that connection where you're transforming the conditioning and seeing the divine aspect and becoming...
Yeah.
Right.
Seeing the divine, I think, is the way to describe it.
Mm.
In terms of the warrior lover, it's a balance, really, of the stereotypical male values, the warrior, and stereotypical compassionate female values within each person. So each person can access both parts of themselves and use that appropriately.
So some people would say that is probably a very nice level of relationship to get to, but you say that there's actually more from there.
I do, yes, I do.
Yeah.
I think the next level up is what I call the monarch, and or sometimes it's easier to call them the monarch pair. And literally it's the next stage up, because when two people are in love and have a good, strong relationship, what they notice and what we notice about them is they have a certain presence. I mean, two warrior lovers come into the room and you think, wow, there's something impressive happening here.
Mm.
And when people are at that level, that's when they become monarchs, really, because they become almost examples for everybody around them and kind of inspiration for everybody around them.
Well, who would you say has that? I mean, is there an example in the public arena that we could look to?
The trouble is that they're not really in the public arena, but I'll give you a couple of examples that I think will work. And that is, you know, let's think of someone very public, like Prince Charles.
Uh-huh.
Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they loved each other before Diana came along, and after Diana was dead, they could just have gone back to what they used to do, which was meet in secret and be, you know, cozy. That would have been going back to sort of orphan mode. But instead of that, I think both of them decided to step forward and say, you know, we really want to be with each other, and we don't particularly mind putting up with a boatload of criticism. And so they stepped forward, and the Queen gave her consent. And here are two very public figures who are saying, we just want to live our lives as an example of how, in a sense, we can get things wrong for a lot of our lives, and yet turn it all around and work towards a real loving, supportive, mutual relationship.
This is getting off the subject, but why couldn't Prince Charles do that before Diana?
Well, quite simply, he was, I think, afraid of his mother, who would never have given her consent to him marrying Camilla Parker Bowles, who had a bit of a reputation, who was already married to somebody else. Yes, so there would have been a big dust-up, and I don't think he had the courage. His experience with Diana gave him the courage to know that he couldn't shortchange himself anymore.
Mm. Well, you know, another example that seems to be in the public eye is Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt.
That's a good one, yeah.
They're sort of the royal couple of the day.
Well, they are, and they don't mind people talking about them, and yet they set a really strong example, don't they? I mean, they have these children, they've adopted children. They really, there's something inspiring about them, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. So you would say that once there's other stages, once, you know, the innocence gives way to the orphan, that gives way to the pilgrim, that to the warrior lover,
yeah.
then people drop in. But that's a long, that's nothing you can find overnight, that monopath.
No. No, I'm afraid this is no instant cure that's being offered here. It takes time. Sometimes being a pilgrim takes some people years before they finally make a commitment. Sometimes people are pilgrims through three or four marriages before they discover, oh, I'm pointed in the wrong direction here. I'm going for the wrong things.
But you're saying the monarch, so you're saying it is rare in our culture to actually come into that place.
Well, I think it is relatively rare, although I can think of people I know who nobody else would perhaps recognize who have reached that level. They aren't nearly as common as I would like them to be, which is why I wrote the book. I think people don't progress if they don't know what they can progress towards. So
right.
Many people settle for second best and they think that's it.
It seems like that is the place to have children, or at least the warrior, before, or at least these last two we just mentioned, because if you have children before that, they suffer the cost of the emotional development of those individuals.
Precisely so. That was beautifully put, yes. The warrior-lover archetype, two warrior lovers working together, that's the place when they can really offer something wonderful to their children. And as monarchs, they learn how to support their children without trying to control them. You know, a monarch doesn't try and control everybody. And at that point, something really wonderful can happen, and that's the magician archetype. Magician is, if you want a down-home comparison, the magician's like the team coach who isn't on the field playing the game, who maybe doesn't say very much, but every word counts, because that's the person who can change the energy of another just by knowing and listening and being there. Now, I've seen couples where, one of them is arguing in the other's face, and the other one just listens, and then when the time is right, says a couple of words that can change the argument into something completely different. And that is that person at that moment showing the magician's ability to create magic in the relationship.
So the magician's, it's not a relationship anymore, it becomes a single person's approach from the monarch?
Oh, it always happens in a relationship, because without some sort of relationship to the other person, they wouldn't listen, or they wouldn't be paying attention. But
so
each of us can only get there in flashes, you see, just little moments of that magic. It's very hard to stay there.
But what creates that? So let's say you've reached the monarch level, which is a pretty rare thing anyway, and you really connected with this person, and there's love, and there's all those deep connections that one would hope to have. When does it show up, the magician? In these arguments you're saying?
Well, it can certainly show up in... I just gave the example of the argument, but sometimes the magician is the person who is best described as being all-accepting, is totally present to the other person, and knows that just as a magician in storybooks casts a spell by using exactly the right words, that is the person who can say to the other, why don't we look at it this way? Or how about thinking about it this way? And I've seen couples be able to be magicians for each other when they can listen to the other person getting overwrought and use that wisdom that they have through knowing each other in order to bring the energy back to something productive.
Can they then transfer that magician archetype to living in the world that way?
Yes, you can. I mean, I've seen magicians who are bosses of companies, and they are the people who, they come into a meeting, they may not say very much, but when they're in the room, everyone's just a little better behaved and a little more intelligent than they normally are. And when they leave the room, people say, oh, you know, it's always so good to have, you know, Fred or Bill or whoever he is around. And what has that person done? That person has been fully present to the other person. Has that other person or the other room full of people feel as though they matter and are fully seen? That's a tough one for any of us to do.
Yeah, no, I've met very few people, but when you meet them, you remember them.
Oh, yes. You certainly do.
Well, people like Eckhart Tolle, I think, is there. And then I had a teacher named Paul Lowe, I thought was there, or Byron Katie, or... do you know any of these people who seem to be living in that place?
Yes, yes. They are comparatively rare, though. I think there are down-home magicians around us who are just known to their families. The public ones are quite remarkable. I mean, as you say, Eckhart Tolle, he's right there, he's right present. He's a loving presence.
Yeah.
He's not going to be critical, he's not going to try and cut anyone down, but he's not going to let any garbage slip by him either, is he? Did you see him with, I'm sure you saw him with Oprah. He caught her out a couple of times and said, oh, really?
He did, and she had no idea what he was talking about.
Well, God bless her. She's a wonderful person, but not quite as elevated as he.
No, she is great, and she's brought a great gift to the public with her, her adventures into consciousness. But but getting back to the book, so that's sort of laying it out, the six archetypes, right? I wouldn't say criticism, but my question is, we're here for more than just relation. I mean, relationships happen, of course, and they're a big part of our life, but it sort of makes it sound in a way that relationships run our lives, and they do on one level, and they don't on another. Can you talk about the rest of our lives and maybe add some of the stories we need to know, that's your other book, into like, okay, we have this love aspect, and it's really beautiful, and it really does consume our deepest thoughts, and it's not everything. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's true. I mean, romantic love, which is really what we've been talking about so far, is only perhaps a part of who we are. But, you know, I think I would have to say that if we are on this planet, if we're on Earth to learn something, one of the inescapable things that we are here to learn, it seems to me, is how to get on with each other.
Mm.
Because no matter where we are, nobody is a hermit. Nobody is alone. We have to interact with each other. And now, more so than ever, I mean, if we're going to make sure our planet and everyone on it survives, so we have to, to some extent, learn the lessons of acceptance and love that can bring us towards peace. And if we don't learn those lessons, we simply won't be here. So there may be many things we're here for, but this is definitely one of the big ones.
Well, you're absolutely right. I have to admit that the truth is that I've been obsessed myself with looking for the romantic love for those stages, and have been, stuck probably in some of those stages. And so where am I now? Which maybe I'm in the pilgrim stage, or how does one get out of the stuck places, let's say, of some of these positions? Maybe we've mentioned some of that already, but if I'm, you know, if I've been through the innocence, and I've been through the orphan, and I've been, you know, now, what's after the orphan? The pilgrim. So now I feel like maybe I'm there, and I've been stuck in this pilgrim stage of, okay, I don't want to be the orphan. I don't want to shut down. I don't want to be abandoned. I want to keep going back in and pursuing that openness, but it's like, maybe I become too, maybe that's so defensive from the orphan stage. I don't know, but I feel maybe there's a place where I am stuck, and I need to get on to the next level. What would you recommend?
Well,
doctor.
The first thing is, if you feel you're stuck, you probably are.
Okay. I was afraid of that.
And most people say, oh, I'm stuck, it's a bad thing, I don't know what to do. And that's when we go back to the familiar, which is usually for most people going back to orphan level. We look for something that's comfortable and predictable. And so people, we find, will date the same sort of person in different disguises for a lifetime. They will marry and make the same mistake 3 or 4 times in a row. And that's when we slip back. But that's why I wrote the book, you see, because most people don't realize there could be anything better, or there could be something a lot better if we're prepared to be patient with the search. The search pilgrim phase. And if we look at that and say, oh, I'm on my own, I'm searching, I'm not finding anything, this is a bad thing, which is what the magazines will tell you. Oh, you're on your own? Oh, that's a bad thing. This is how you find a lover. Then we're not going to honor that inner search where we say, well, what do I actually want? I can give you an example of one of the people I worked with who spent years dating the wrong kind of men. And at a certain point, she said to herself, I know what I want. And she sort of made a pronouncement. She said, I want a person who's interested in this and this and this, and I want... And she said, that's what I want. And once she clarified what she wanted as a pilgrim, when she went out there into the world, suddenly she was able to sort out, you know, the wheat from the chaff or the sheep from the goats. And in a very short time, she said, oh, I found exactly the person that I want. Mm. And built a relationship with that person. And suddenly it all seemed as though it was miraculous. But no, it was more a case of when you go into that pilgrim stage, then it clarifies what it is you want to commit your energy, your life, your emotions to. So we often have to go back into that phase. If we've had an unsuccessful love affair, which maybe was good for a while, then we need to go back to be the searching pilgrim and find again what it is that we truly need.
So in that searching pilgrim phase, and we don't have to just focus on that phase, but you also in the book illustrate certain tarot cards that
yes.
represent an aspect of that archetype. So in the pilgrim phase, there's the hermit, and then there's the wheel of fortune and justice, and the hangman, particularly from what I know of tarot, is where someone then has to go into themselves, into their own psyche, like this woman saying, oh, I know what I want. But it's deeper than that. It's like we have to find out something about ourselves in the hangman position, right?
Yes, we do. Yes.
And what that's the place. Where do we look inside ourselves to find out what we really want and what we haven't gotten yet?
Yes. This is going to be a question that will vary for just about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The tarot cards are fascinating because I'm not an expert in card reading or anything of that sort, but the major arcana of the tarot pack seem to reflect almost perfectly these 6 stages that are all through Western literature's greatest works for 3,500 years. So it looks as though they're talking about the same thing, how we can grow through the stages. Now, as a pilgrim, I suspect that the things we will have to learn are perhaps mirrored to some extent in these cards. And the things that we will have to learn about include, well, you know, there's the hanged man, which is reversal. How do we deal with our lack of success? How do we actually deal with our failures? Well, one of the ways to deal with failures is to realize that actually, you learn a lot more from failure than you learn from success. When one is successful, that there's no need to rethink anything.
Well, it's just a process. I mean, Thomas Edison went through 1,000 different substances to get the tungsten filament to make the light bulb. So each one of his failures was a process of learning something about. So I guess that's how you get through it.
That's exactly it, yeah. Mm. I mean, the cards that I identify there are quite suggestive. I mean, there's the hanged man, the failures, there's death. I mean, death is all about not so much death, but how are we going to value this life? What do we value in this life now? And thinking about death will provoke those thoughts, which is another way of saying, how do you want your life to be, and how do you get more of that into your life? So the person who dreams of a horse farm in Kansas, who is living in New York City, you'd have to say, well, it's okay to dream, but are you going to do something about that? if you want to be in Kansas, you probably should get there.
And what about the devil in the pilgrim? What's that mean for you?
Yeah, the devil, well, the devil card is really interesting because the figures in front of the devil and for the classic tarot pack, Rider-Waite, which Joseph Campbell swore by, of course, are a man and a woman in chains. And you see that they're in chains. They've somehow taken on these roles that they think that somehow they have to be less than themselves, chained to a vision of what being a man or being a woman should be. And so it's not so much devil, we should all, you know, make the sign of the cross and quiver in our boots. It's more the sense of getting trapped in a role. Now, a pilgrim can say, oh, I'm on a pilgrimage, so I'm going to try a new lover every week. And that's not really a pilgrimage. That's just a self-indulgence that really has more to do with the orphan repeating behaviors than a real pilgrim.
You're saying about the devil, just getting out of these, I mean, part of the pilgrim is looking at oneself, the hermit, and looking at oneself long enough to realize that maybe the idea we had about ourselves in a relationship, it wasn't really who we were or what we wanted.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this works in life as well. I mean, I knew a man who thought he was going to be a fiction writer. He was going to be a fiction writer, and he wrote 4 huge fiction books, which nobody wanted and were really not very good. And then he discovered that actually what he was good at was nonfiction writing. That, I've had the wrong impression about myself.
But they could only have gotten there because they did look at some parts of themselves honestly and clearly and saying, this is not really making me happy.
That's exactly it, which is what the pilgrim has to experience.
Because I'm just... Yeah. No, go ahead, because I'm just feeling...
The pilgrim make a lot of mistakes.
No, the pilgrim is that pivotal point, it seems, in your laying out of the archetype.
It is, yeah.
We go from the... Yeah, the lower.
But it is a pivotal point, which is why the Wheel of Fortune is in that section as well.
So explain the Wheel of Fortune.
Well, the Wheel of Fortune is an old idea, and it is a wheel, like Vanna White turns with in that dreadful TV show that so many people watch. But the whole point about the original Wheel of Fortune was that if you attached yourself to the rim, the outer edge, you could be quickly propelled to the top. You could have a wonderful rise in fortunes. But because the wheel was constantly turning, you could equally quickly be tipped off and go to the bottom. This is the 15 minutes of fame, and then, you know, it's all over. The trick about the Wheel of Fortune, which the card is trying to tell us, is that we have to work out of the center of ourselves, the center of the wheel, where we are stable and where fortune is stable. And that, when we find out who we are, you know, if any of us become wildly famous tomorrow, we probably won't discover who we are quite as well as if we're in a slightly calmer place, observing and thinking and saying, well, who am I when the fuss and the flap is not happening?
Well, we could still become wildly famous if we've already gone through those places.
That would be nice.
Well, why not?
I wish it for us both.
Well, it might be someday. Which brings us to the two other cards in the Pilgrim archetype, is Justice and Temperance, which is finding the balance within ourselves.
Precisely. Temperance is all about balance. The figure has two cups, one in each hand, and is emptying one into another. Justice has the scales. It's about finding the balance. What is true over and over again? What is true? That's what the Pilgrim asks. What's true? Not what would I like to be true, or what would suit my vision to be the case, but what actually feels true.
So as a literature professor, let me then ask you about the classic, you know, love archetype, which is, you know, Romeo and Juliet. And,
oh, yes.
And I've studied different critical analysis of that, and many people say because that love was so pure, in a way, innocent, it couldn't last in this world. You know, it's not a love of this world. Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, there's also the Tristan and Isolde myth. But let's talk about Romeo and Juliet. Why does that young love have to die like that?
Well, the classic answer is that, as you said, their love is so pure and so special, and the dictates of the outer world crush their marvelous purity of spirit. I think that's a reasonable interpretation, but what it doesn't bear in mind is that if these two had been given a chance, their love might well have continued to grow, and it might well have moved into a better space. Now, they are innocent when they first meet. They're both sexually innocent and somewhat unsuspecting. But notice, almost as soon as they're in that orchard together, they're both saying, I want you, I don't care about my family. Mm-hmm. And you think to yourself, oh, so they're orphans. They're attaching themselves to each other. And then you think, well, that's not very good, except that Shakespeare is absolutely clear, because he tests both of them. He tests both of them with their willingness to die for the other. Warrior, lover. I mean, Romeo does fight for his love, or his reputation. He makes a mistake. He makes the wrong fight. And then as a result of that, he's sent off. He's banished. So he becomes a pilgrim. When he's on his pilgrimage, and remember, Juliet takes the potion and sort of dies, or seems to die, because she's taken this potion. So both of them go on a pilgrimage towards oblivion, and they realize that actually it is each other that they need, that they can't do their lives without being in this relationship. When Romeo comes back, he comes back as this fearsome person. Most people don't remember the play terribly well, but he comes to Juliet's tomb, and there's Paris, who was supposed to have been married to Juliet by the family, you know, real orphan marriage. And Romeo says, you know, you better get out of my way, because what I feel is too big to deal with conventional folks like you, he says to Paris. Paris, being conventional, says, well, you know, you're a villain, and he draws his sword, and then Romeo promptly kills him, says, I've got no time for people like this. Just kill him. And then he takes a rock or and batters his way into the tomb. This is not a man who is going to be a milksop. This is a man who is energized, who is on fire because of his thwarted love. He gets there, he finds Juliet dead, as he thinks. And he killed himself, interestingly enough, with poison, which is, she drank poison or a potion in order to feign death. And then, if I can bore you with a few more details.
No, please, because I think it's very interesting, actually, so please.
Yeah, I mean, death really is the final touchstone. Are you prepared to fight to death? That's the warrior lover right there.
Mm.
And Juliet wakes up, finds him dead, and she says, well, that's it, I've got to kill myself. She doesn't hesitate. She doesn't say, oh, well, I think I'll creep away someplace and join a nunnery or whatever. And she picks up his dagger and kills herself with... she first tries to drink the poison and none left, and she grabs his dagger and kills herself with that. And you think, well, that's odd, until you realize that they both speak the same metrical verse when they die. I mean, Juliet says, oh, happy dagger, here, rest and let me sleep. Oh, that's an interesting... I mean, a happy dagger, that's weird. And then you remember Romeo's last words, where he says, oh, true apothecary, thy drugs are quick. I drink and let me sleep. I mean, the two statements mirror each other. True apothecary who sells you poison, absolutely true. It's without getting into the language too much,
yeah.
To mirror each other perfectly.
But what is Shakespeare trying to tell us with that?
What Shakespeare, I think, is trying to tell us is that huge idealism that we saw in them as innocents when they first met, that stage they went through as orphans when they clung together, and then quickly they became pilgrims having to undergo trials for each other, but they've made it as far as warrior lover, where they're prepared to die for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say to yourself, well, what happened to the monarch?
Yeah.
And that's where Shakespeare's magic comes in, because he is quite extraordinary. When they are found dead,
mm-hmm.
what the rival families do is they look at these two dead children, really,
yeah.
and they
yeah.
realize that each family's name has been effectively wiped out. So, Juliet is the only daughter, Romeo is the only son. So both families have been completely destroyed through love and through background of hatred. And that allows both Montague and Capulet to declare peace with each other.
Hmm.
And they become, as it were, the monarchs of the situation, putting an end to what's basically a civil war.
Huh. And well, that's beautiful. No, I think that's a really beautiful analysis of these archetypes. And so how do we use, like, that story, which people like are always, you know, I'm a romantic idealist, so how do we use that story and all the archetypes, I mean, you've been talking about it, to navigate our relationships in a clearly defined, a sober manner?
Well, clearly defined in relationships is a difficult
right.
concept, because every relationship is so different.
Yeah.
But again, what I say is, you know, in my counseling sessions, I will work with individual people on the individual ramifications of this. But to some extent, if we know there are these six stages, and if we read these old stories that can tell us about these six stages, what we'll find is the most incredible wisdom that stretches in every available direction. And once we're familiar with it, we can see whether we're behaving from the best possible version of ourselves.
Well, how do we know that, though? Let's just go into that. How do we know if we're behaving from the best? I mean, how do we judge that?
Well, we know what an orphan wants. An orphan just wants to be accepted, just wants to be looked after, and just wants to fit in. And we know when we're doing that. We know when we're not really being authentic to ourselves, just in order to fit in.
Mm.
And so if we're alert to that, we can say, oh, you know, I'm behaving a bit like an orphan today. Is that the best version of who I am? And then we've got choices. Now, we can take whatever choice we want. It's a free world. And, you know, there are wonderful, loving people who are basically orphans. But until we know that that is the situation, we don't have the roadmap to show us what's on the road ahead. And if we don't know what's on the road ahead, we're likely to sit down right here and say, oh, this is okay, I can deal with this.
Oh, so that's, I mean, you said it before, but now I get the value of what you've laid out, the value that there's a map to like a higher spiritual possibility that lies in our connecting to, in relationships, but the evolution of that, and in a way, and not to settle on something that doesn't at least attain of the warrior lover, or coming into a sense of presence as a monarch, and that ability as the magician to manifest in the world.
Yes, anyone can choose to settle wherever he or she wishes. As I say, it's a free world. But if we know there's more, and we have choices, then we can say, oh, there's better stuff up ahead if I want to hold out for it.
So
what's what I end up to do.
Yeah. So what pieces of literature inspired you especially the last three, to get to that place? Like, because, you know, there's a lot of literature, like in a lot of relationships, that never achieve the monarch or the magician level.
Yes, indeed. And particularly so in the last, really the last 200 years. It's as though our civilization has stopped really believing in these ancient archetypes, which has been there forever.
Mm.
So the ones that inspired me from the beginning really are, Shakespeare obviously knew this stuff splendidly, but also the great classics like the Odyssey.
Well, the Odyssey, though, is interesting. I was going to mention that because the time Odysseus reaches Ithaca and comes, and it's very funny, you know, he's gone 20 years, and then he returns to Penelope and says, how do I know it's you? And all this, it doesn't seem, it really gets off on the wrong foot. It's very humorous. It's like, you know, don't you think so? They're like, it's like, who are you, and who made this bet? And I mean, go into that a little bit, because it's not what you think it would be.
Mm-hmm.
In the Odyssey,
it's true. I'm a little more charitable towards it, I must say, because I think that when Odysseus is wandering for 20 years around the Mediterranean, which I always tell people is not that big. I mean, for you to last 20 years there, you really have to try. But if you notice the people he encounters, most of them are powerful women.
Mm-hmm.
There's Calypso, there's
Circe,
Nausicaa,
Calypso,
and Circe, and these are powerful women.
The sirens, yes.
The sirens, I mean, he has to stop his ears with wax and have himself tied to the mast, because the sexual allure is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
So Odysseus is, you might say, a love adventurer at this point. And, I mean, Circe, you know, she's all about domination. She turns men into animals, particularly twice. Nausicaa offers him, I come back to Nausicaa, because Calypso offers him golden handcuffs. She says, stay here with me and you can be a demigod and I'll look after you. And he could do that, except it would mean that he would have to go against his men, to whom he's loyal, his wife, his son, his kingdom, and he toys with it for a number of years, and then he says, you know, I can't live with myself as in this golden cage. And the last, he also, you know, he meets other women as well, particularly the ghost of his mother, which I think is very important. And then he meets Nausicaa, who he could take advantage of her. She's a young girl. She's besotted by him. She could really be a victim. And, you know, by this point, he's learned. He doesn't take advantage of her. He goes to her father and says, I need some help here. Mm. Father says, okay, I'll give you boats, and I'll send you home. Now, all of that is because he's going to go back to Ithaca to encounter a strong woman.
Mm.
Penelope has kept the place going for 20 years
mm-hmm.
on her own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She's outwitted the suitor. She's a strong woman.
Right.
And it doesn't tell much. And notice, who is protecting Odysseus throughout this? It's actually the goddess Athena, who
mm-hmm.
is one of the strongest female goddesses you can imagine. She's usually depicted wearing armor. She's so strong.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, she's almost androgynous. She's so strong.
Right, she's that powerful matriarchal feminine energy. Yeah. So what does it say when he comes home, and how does he deal with Penelope, and how does it talk about the relationships we need to have?
Okay, when he comes back to Penelope, he arrives alone, poor, bedraggled. Nobody recognizes him except for the dog and his old nursemaid. And I think that's significant because, you know, the nursemaid knew him before he could talk, and the dog knows who he is rather than anything he says.
Mm-hmm.
So that's emblematic of him being recognizable for that core of the person that he always was.
Mm-hmm.
And he works from that core and from his inside knowledge that the bed is in fact a tree, has been made from a rooted tree, that the bow can only be bent by himself, and so on. He works from that knowledge to claim back his rightful place as Penelope's husband. Now, how does that translate to us? Because
yes.
we're not going to do what...
We're almost out of time, too, but...
Okay.
But yes.
Well, Ulysses, God bless him, Odysseus, has to remember who he is at his instinctual level, that he is loving and trusting and wonderful, and then mobilize his fierceness, his warrior side of the lover, in order to get rid of these other suitors. And he does that by saying, what do I know about me and my life that I know that nobody else knows? It's a metaphor for look within, find your strength, and operate from that. Operate from what's authentically you.
Well, the Homer starts out with him declaring the being the resourceful person that he is, right?
Yes. He's very resourceful. But he's also a trickster.
Mm-hmm.
He was the trickster of the Trojan group. He invented the wooden horse, which is a trick. Wily Odysseus. He's not wise Odysseus. Now he comes back, and he's asked to be wise and not judge Penelope in any way. I mean, she's been doing an impossible job extremely well. And then he gets to fight. And she recognizes him right away and says, oh, it's him. It's him. She doesn't reproach him. She doesn't say, what kept you? She says, you're back. Good.
Your dinner's cold, yeah.
Your dinner's cold and we're all set up.
So you're saying, just to sum it up, because I think that's a good place to kind of wrap it, is that like, in these relationships, in any stage, we have to find these resources inside ourselves to be our authentic self, beyond the language, beyond the fancy words or whatever it is, to just find that depth of dropping into this pure part. And that's ultimately what we're loved for, is that it's not what we say or do, it's who we are.
Who we are, yes. It's not whether we've got good hair today or bad hair today.
Mm-hmm.
It's who we are in our center that people love us for, just because we are authentic. People don't get loved because they try to be somebody they're not. And everybody knows a fake when they see one. That's where we lose love. The story of Odysseus again and again says, don't get caught up in pride or what you can get away with. Act from the center of who you know yourself to be, that inner knowing. And then really amazing stuff happens. And he gets rid of the suitors. He actually kills them. And then their parents and their relatives come along and want to kill him. And that's when Athena steps forward. It's a little more complicated than that. And that's when Athena steps forward and arranges the battle so that Odysseus and his father, interestingly, his father, manage to win the battle, and the relatives say, oh, okay, I see how it is. And they go home. They don't pursue a vendetta. That's the magic which Athena completes.
And then he steps in finally from the being that wandering pilgrim into the, well, he's been the warrior lover, but into the monarch and into the magician ultimately.
Exactly. I mean, he is de facto a monarch because he's running the island, and he's got to, you know, he's got to rely on Penelope to get him up to date on what the island has been doing. So he has to work with her in equality. And when he does that, that's when the magic happens. That's when
Athena comes. Well, that's the key point, I think, in all modern relationships, is that we have to treat men and women as equal to each other so we can be co-rulers of our life if we're in that partnership.
Yes, and, indeed, I think so. It's got to be respectful and understanding on both sides.
Well, this has been a fascinating journey from the innocence to the magician, the six archetypes of love. And
it's been a pleasure to be here talking about them because they have a lot of validity. And I didn't invent them. They've been in Western literature for at least 3,500 years, and we've forgotten that they're there. But they can be very useful.
So thank you. I've been talking to Dr. Alan Huntner, Hunter, yes. And, and you are a professor at Curry College in Massachusetts and the author of The Six Archetypes of Love, From the Innocent to the Magician. And you're also the author of Stories We Need to Know, huh? Let's do an interview about that sometime, okay?
That would be really a delight. This has been so much fun, Alan. Thank you for having me on the program. And I hope we can talk again soon.
No, definitely. This will be archived on BBS Radio. It will also be archived on newrealities.com. I'll send you a link about that. And thank you for being a guest. And
it's been a real pleasure to be on BBS.com. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you have any questions, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com, and stay tuned next week, same time, different guests, more information and knowledge. Thank you.